Good evening, everyone. Welcome back again. I don't have any. The only announcement I have this evening is that we still don't have the practice for Chenrezig book in the bookstore, but you can get it as a downloadable PDF for about $4 from the FPMT Foundation bookstore, and instructions for doing that are in the handout. That's all my announcement. If a few of you could stick around afterwards and help rearrange the furniture, it'd be much appreciated. Thank you.
Testing.
Three principal aspects.
Yeah. We're going to do that prayer in just a minute. Well, it's in the gold book, 141. So we're going to do that. But before we do that, we'll do a little kind of a centering practice. Meditation on your, whatever you choose to, really. Oh gosh, there's so many different things. You could do a mantra, and there's some people here have, you know, like to meditate on a mantra, the sound of mantra. That's great. You can focus on your breath as kind of a neutral object. In the Tibetan, the teachings on shine or calm abiding, where you develop single pointed concentration in the sutra system. They recommend a visualized image of the Buddha because that's something positive, but you got to be able to visualize, and that's not easy. But anyway, we'll just maybe work with the breath because that's easy. So we'll do a few minutes of mindfulness of the breath. And start out with three deep breaths, breathing in through your, so that people around you can hear you. Make a little racket. Breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth three times. Just kind of blow out the anxiety and whatever's going on today. Choose whatever object you're most familiar with. Could be, as I said, the breath, and wherever you can most readily notice it. It could be, you know, you could put your hands on your stomach and just feel the tummy going up and down, up and down. Or the sensation of the breath at the nostril. You can also do nine-round breathing too at this point. But the point is to just bring your mind to one pointedness and let go of any of the discursive talk that's going on in your head. And since the nature of the mind is to chatter, you're going to be distracted. And when you are, you bring the mind back gently but firmly. And your contract with yourself is to keep your focus on this one object, whatever it might be. So even though we're not going to do the refuge and bodhicitta prayer tonight, that's sort of the context of everything that we do here. And the thoughts that should always come to mind when we think of refuge, there are three things that we're encouraged to reflect on. Just not start talking or say the refuge formula, but think, okay, I'm going to refuge first based on sort of a genuine appreciation for how difficult life is and will be with the kind of mind that we have. So it's like, wow, this is not going to go well. So we have to recognize that, have to develop a sense of dread for living our lives with a mind that's caught in some crazy cycle of what we call samsara. It's uncontrolled causation. And it's not going to stop without some effort. But we understand that it can be stopped. That within that understanding that it can be stopped. So that's really important. And then we have some faith, confidence that the Buddhas, the Dharma, the teachings of the enlightened beings, those realizations actually of those teachings, and the Sangha, the spiritual community that guide us, that we have strong confidence that these are reliable guides. And then the third aspect is compassion, not just ordinary compassion for those that are close, our loved ones, but this thing we call universal response, this sense of universal, great compassion, universal responsibility. It's that kind of compassion. So based on that, that's the basis of Buddhist Refuge, which is the whole context of what we do at Kadampa Center. And then we're going to read the three principles of the path. And I think it's good to understand that this teaching, you know, and I'll speak a little bit more about it, but we have to put it in the context of a path. You know, that is something that I think is so, that's very special about Tibetan Buddha Dharma, is that, you know, teachings have, the Buddha had like 84,000 teachings. I mean, so much. And that the teachings that actually came to Tibet, you know, there were just thousands and thousands of texts. There were the sutra teachings of the Buddha and the tantric teachings, all of that. And so how would you wrap your mind around it? But here it is, distilled down into three principles of the path. Tantra is not included here, but these are the key features of the sutra path, and these are the things that we need to know. And the second of the three is bodhicitta. So, you know, we'll get to that point. If you're using this in meditation at home, you might read through the part up until you got to the point where you're talking about, the purpose of generating the mind of enlightenment and so forth. I think it's 6, 7, 8 and like that. And you might spend more time meditating on bodhicitta. But let's do this prayer together. I bow down to my perfect... I bow down to my perfect gurus, the essential meaning of the victorious one's teachings, the path praised by all the holy victors and their children, the gateway of the fortunate ones desiring liberation. This I'll try to explain as much as I can. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling samsara, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones, you fortunate ones, listen with a calm mind. Without the complete intention definitely to be free from circling, there is no way to pacify attachment seeking pleasurable effects in the ocean of circling. Also, by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. Freedom and endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. By thinking over and over again that action then their effects are unbetraying, and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, attraction to the appearances of future lives is reversed. When by having trained in that way, there is no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfection of cyclic existence, and all day and night the intention seeking liberation arises, then the thought of renunciation has been generated. Now, wait 1 minute. Let's go back for just a second, because we want to have a taste of this before we even talk about bodhicitta. So, how to generate renunciation? So they're talking about freedom and endowments are difficult to find. So what's that talking? What particular teaching is that in the Lam realm? It's the precious human rebirth, the 8 freedoms and 10 endowments, which basically said simply is, you know, we're so fortunate. We're alive. We're human beings. We're intelligent. We're not crazy. We have some interest in the Dharma. The teachings are available to us. Examples of the teachings, living beings to inspire and teach us, are present. You know, we're so lucky. That's what that means. This is like a precious opportunity. We're so lucky. And life has no time to spare. So it's like, that's the teaching on death and impermanence, isn't it? It's like, bam, could be gone any minute. Could be gone any minute. Just one little tiny blood clot, so tiny, completely destroy your life. Take it away in a split second. So gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. So seeing the preciousness of this life and remembering how fleeting and how ephemeral and how fragile it is, could be gone any minute. By having those two recognitions, the attraction to the appearances of this life are reversed. And he says, thinking over and over again that action and their effects are unbetraying. So that's karma, isn't it? Everything we do comes back to us eventually. Everything, every action of body, speech, and mind plants potentials on the mind stream that come back just like a boomerang. And repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, it's like there is no place in samsara where you can rest. There's no place in samsara where we will ever find true satisfaction and happiness. So thinking over and over again that actions, you know, are absolutely, you know, karma is this law of causality. It is immutable. It is the way it is. We have to get that. And then repeatedly remembering that, hey, we have done nothing but create the causes for future suffering. You know, we haven't done a lot of virtue. Certainly not enough. And so the future doesn't look that good if we don't do something. So the attraction to the appearances of future life is reversed. So this is to get us motivated to go, wow, precious life could be gone any minute. You know, what goes around comes around. Lots of negative karma has been created. I've suffered a lot in the past. I'll suffer more in the future. I need to do something now to escape the sort of determination to be free. So this is what the generating bodhicitta is all about. So all day and night, the intention seeking liberation arises. Then the thought of renunciation has been generated. So that's called realization. So day and night, it's part of our, it's in our being. It just, you know, we are constantly aware of this sort of determination to be free of suffering. And certainly within that is the determination not to create more causes for suffering. That's part of the foundation for generating bodhicitta. So now we'll go on with number six. All right. Even if renunciation has been developed, it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment. It does not become the cause of the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Swept away by the current of four powerful rivers, tied in tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped by the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings, thinking that all mothers are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Then the definition. In short, if like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire and who experiences even 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity, your reflection on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering for even 1 second, and the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort, then you realize the supreme precious mind of enlightenment. Now this, you know, when you're doing your practice at home, and here's a great time, you can go through, read through this, and then once we've gotten through all 12, they're actually, I'm counting equanimity as one, but they're, usually they say 11 meditations, but they're 12. You know, this would be a good time to review these 12 points. All right, now we'll do the, let me just say one other thing about bodhicitta. So Shantideva said, all the Buddhist teachings, if you could, you know, put them in a churn and distill them, the essence of all the Buddhist teachings is bodhicitta, which I think is kind of interesting because usually we think of emptiness as being the most important thing. And then there's ultimate bodhicitta, which is emptiness, but conventional bodhicitta is what we're talking about developing here. But this is like the door to the Mahayana. It's the key to, you know, every, it opens up all the possibilities of these higher practices. And without this Buddha Dharma from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, it's just dry. It doesn't get you where you want to go. All right, so we'll read the last part. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you've generated renunciation and the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent arising. One who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence and the state beyond forever unbetraying, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. If the appearance of dependent relation, which is unbetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, then one has not realized the Buddha's intent. If these two realizations are happening simultaneously without alternation, and for merely seeing dependent relation as completely unbetraying, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys the way all objects are apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. Furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, then you're not captivated by wrong notion holding extreme views. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points, three principles of the path. Resorting to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child. So there are a lot of teachers, you might say, that but Western, you know, intellectual scholars that intellectually understand emptiness. You know, this last part that we just read that seems so hard, you know, I mean, it's like, are you kidding me? What did that mean? Very difficult to understand what the Buddha is talking about when he's talking about this ultimate, this supreme, what's called the seeing things as they are, this direct insight into reality, called the emptiness of inherent existence. There are a lot of people that understand that, but it's said, and I asked Jeffrey Hopkins this one time. I said, what is it about bodhicitta that makes it so important? And he said. Without bodhicitta, without the compassion, the great compassion, and bodhicitta is more than compassion, but it's this altruistic intention to become enlightened for the sake of others. Without that attitude and the tremendous amount of positive karma that we can create because of that attitude, it empowers the wisdom consciousness, because just intellectually understanding emptiness doesn't make our lives any different. The intellectual understanding does not help us deal with our anger and fear and delusions. It has to become a realization. And so to do that, the wisdom consciousness needs to be empowered by bodhicitta. And so we always talk about the two wings of the bird to enlightenment. One is compassion, but again, bodhicitta, and the other is wisdom. So it's a big deal. It's a very big deal when we talk about developing bodhicitta. Now I'm going to read something to try to, I don't know, I'm not going to say scare you, but it's just a good recollection, because the teachings say it's important to remember death and impermanence at the beginning of any session of practice, in the middle, and at the end. Otherwise, we waste our time. So this particular little quote that I like, and I read frequently myself to get going, is good. It's from Heart Spoon. This is a whole text, but this is just one little bit of it. Encouragement through recollecting impermanence. All the hurt, Khan Lama, look to this pitiful one, how I behave and how I've cheated myself my entire life. Please look upon this monoless one with compassion. The essential advice to give yourself, heart spoon. Keep it deep within your heart. Don't be distracted. Don't be distracted. Reflect upon the state of your life from the essential drop at your heart. Since beginningless cyclic existence, which hasn't ended up till now, though you've experienced countless cycles of rebirth, just so many variations on happiness and pain, you've achieved not the slightest of benefit from them. And though at present you've attained leisure and fortune so difficult to find, always till now they've finished and have been lost, have been empty and without meaning. Now, if you care about yourself, the time has come to practice the essence of future happiness, virtuous actions. You appear so capable, smart, clever, but you're a fool. As long as you cling to the child's play of the appearances of this life, suddenly you're overwhelmed by the fearful lord of death, and without hope or means to endure, there's nothing you can do. This is going to happen to you. Now, don't be distracted. Right this moment is the time to steal your will. It's not only time, it is almost too late. Right now, apply yourself with great force. Holy precept of the Lama, kind father, heart of the authoritative scriptures of the victorious Losong, practice of the pure path of complete sutra and tantra, it's time to place real experience upon your mind stream. This last part has to do with bodhicitta. Who's faster, Yama, the lord of death, or you in your practice of realizing the essence of your eternal dream, the welfare of both yourself and others as much as you can each day? Unifying the three doors of your body, speech, and mind, put the whole of your effort into practice. So let me read this last part again. Who's the faster, Yama, the lord of death, or you in your practice of realizing the essence of your eternal dream, the welfare of both yourself and others, as much as you can each day? Unifying the three doors of your body, speech, and mind, put the whole of your effort into your practice. So, encouragement through recollecting impermanence. And it does create a little, you can call it fear, but it's the kind of fear that keeps us from walking through red lights and driving 85 and a 25. It's healthy. It's a good kind of dread. Now, at the last class, part of the homework was to see if you can bring the practice equanimity in your life and discuss it with your buddy or other class next week. So just take a couple of minutes and talk to one other person and tell them how, if you didn't do it, you don't have to say anything, but if you did, if you were able to recollect equanimity and you did the practice, did it help you? How did it help you? So let's do that for a couple of minutes. And if it didn't do it, maybe how could it have helped you? Yeah, if you'd done it, how could it have helped you?
Yeah. They're friends of my child, but quite a big name. Yeah.
What's the damn?
Yeah.
What time is it? Do you know what time it is? Is it 7:45? 7:46? Does that sound right? Got me on a 24-hour clock here. Okay. All right. So let's get back and do another meditation on equanimity now. And I'm going to give you some little definitions from my book here that are, I think, very cool and helpful because and some of this, when I read this, something kind of shocked me. I'll tell you what it was in a minute. So let me hear from you what you think equanimity is first. What is it? Anybody raise your hand if you think you have it. We got a taker over here. What is it?
Is it like not feeling either attraction, like desire, or aversion, and you know being repulsed? It's having that middle way of seeing all things as empty and having a kind of a balance and composure as a result of not letting the good stuff bring you up or the bad stuff bring you down or make you angry. Is that close?
That's really good. It's really good.
Yeah, but is it correct answer?
I'll tell you, it's close enough. But we have there are other kinds. Anybody else? Anybody want to add or subtract to that? We have one over here. A taker.
Yeah. It makes me think of what that meditation you gave us last week about the three people in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, it's a complete stranger, it's a person you love, and it's a person you hate, and treating all of them exactly the kind, with loving kindness and respect.
Uh-huh. Now see, this is tricky. It's tricky, but it's not even quite there yet. Not quite there yet. But I used to think that. I used to go, well, it must be equal love for everybody. But it's not. Equanimity is not that. It's equal regard for everyone. But we haven't actually done anything to... Well, go ahead, Robbie, did you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, I think we need to be careful that we don't fall to one extreme and think that it's being equally indifferent to everyone. It's not just not caring at all about anyone.
Yeah.
I think it's a sense of being equally connected.
Well, you know, this is one thing that this textbook, which I used in 2004, 11 years ago, when I did this class last time. Anyway, this is a great textbook. And Gareth Sparrow, who's a Westerner and a monk at the time, translated, and he said, this may well be the most extensive Tibetan text devoted to the subject of bodhicitta, because it was written. It wasn't translated, you know, like a lot of things are. And so here's what Venerable Lobsang Gatso says. He's talking about different kinds of equanimity. One of them is kind of a neutral and mind. And we don't need to meditate to develop a neutral state of mind. That's not necessarily a meditative accomplishment. Another kind of equanimity is what we experience when we try to meditate, when we develop single-pointed concentration, where we have excitement or lethargy, and we're trying to develop that stable concentration that's free of this kind of up and down. That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about this kind of equanimity. This is, he says there are many levels of this type of equanimity, but essentially it is a state in which all attitudes of attachment and anger toward any sentient being, irrespective of who they are overcome. So, you know, I think what you said is very close, but it doesn't matter. Friends, enemies, strangers, everybody, there's no attachment or anger toward any classification of being, irrespective of who they are. Then he goes on to say, now, how many people here think that rebirth is like a little crazy? Off the... Raise your hand. Be honest, it's okay. All right. How many people think there's a remote possibility it could be true? Yeah, and how many people know it's true? Pretty confident it's true, yeah. So the latter group is in a better place than we're... But here's what he says. He said, if you realize that there has been no starting point to the continuous cycle of rebirths. Okay, we're talking about equanimity here. That there's no place in, there's no, it's like space. You go, okay, where does space start? You know, you get to a point, you go, well, there's something beyond that. There's no place where there's a beginning to space, is it? It's infinite in every direction. Similarly, if you take a timeline now, there's no beginning. You can't find a first point in time. There's always a moment before that. So rebirth is thought to be the same way. Our consciousness, this moment of consciousness, has always had to be the product of something that came before it, which is a former moment of consciousness. And so that is the most powerful reasoning that Buddhists use for gaining confidence in rebirth. Now, Here's where I was, and I'm more confident in rebirth now than I've ever been. But it's been like 37 years of playing with this, or longer. I'm still, you know, and I invite you, those of you who are pretty sure that it's not true, I invite you to creatively align. That's my invitation. Let's just pretend like karma and rebirth are the way it is, and see if anything good happens to our minds. I think that's a good way to look at it. So he says, if you realize that there had been no starting point to the continuous cycle of births, then instilling a sense of equanimity will not prove difficult. Without this realization, however, you will encounter great problems. Furthermore, failure to meditate on this point will not only condemn whatever Dharma practice, and he's talking about equanimity now, failure to meditate on equanimity will not only condemn whatever Dharma practice you perform to eventual failure, it will also expose your attempts to the risk of becoming non-virtuous. So, reflecting on the points mentioned here as well as the shortcomings of attachment and aversion. So when we're trying to develop equanimity, you may not even want to give up attachment, right? If you think about it, like, oh my God, that's where I get my juice from attachment. I don't want to give that up. And it's like in Buddhism, what do you think? You think giving up attachment means giving up pleasure? And fun and having a good, I mean, having bliss and all that? Is it the same thing? Help me, people. Why?
You're just spreading it across all three groups.
Pardon?
You're spreading all that good feeling across all three groups.
What do you mean?
That if you have really good feelings towards a group of, you know, someone that you're attached to, and then aversion, you don't, then you take the good feelings and you kind of have the same feeling towards people.
No, but we're not talking about equally attached to everybody. We're talking about giving up attachment. And the Buddhist notion here is that, you know, is I'm asking the question, is giving up attachment going to give us nothing? I mean, is attachment... I mean, don't we sort of in this... Isn't it a cultural conversation that attachment... is a good thing? and that, you know, it's the cause of a lot of fun, a lot of good feelings, a lot of bliss, a lot of suffering too, isn't it? Yeah. So, you know, and this very much gets into the whole question of Tantra and blah, 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 because in Tantra, on the Tantric path in Buddhism, we actually work to cultivate attachment and then use that blissful energy of attachment to meditate, not the attachment, let the attachment go, but use that energized, blissful state of consciousness to then meditate on reality. So, but in the sutra level, attachment causes all kinds of problems, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the point of this is that we can't even enjoy ordinary sensual pleasures because clinging pollutes it. It pollutes the pleasure. It pollutes. Until we can let go of clinging, then physical pleasures, the pleasures of the senses, you know, the sort of what we call the eight worldly concerns, where we're attached to pleasure, of course, right? We're attached to pleasure. We're attached to things. We're attached to a good reputation, and we're attached to people's approval. We're attached to approval. Okay. Now, having pleasure and things and a good reputation and approval are not bad. They're great. It's wonderful to have that. But as long as we cling, we're gonna poison it. We're not gonna be able to truly enjoy it. And the more I'm attached to a person, right? What happens when they say sayonara? Pow! The more we suffer. The more attached to that new car. Actually, Robbie had this experience one time. When somebody keys your new car, you go, oh my God, it feels personal, doesn't it, Robbie? Like, oh my God, the more we attach to something, the more we suffer when we lose it, the less we can enjoy it when we're having the experience of it, whatever it is, the more we attach to a good reputation when somebody, you know, when somebody badmouths us, what? The more we suffer. True? So attachment looks like a friend, but it's actually a huge problem for us, and we need to identify it as such. And so, you know, in this whole view of equanimity, we have attachment to the friends, and we think that's all great. Well, when we start analyzing attachment, we see that's not such a good state of mind to cultivate. It creates a lot of problems for us. And when he's talking about past and future lifetimes, what we're talking about here has very much to do with the very, very first meditation, which is seeing everyone has been in every conceivable... Again, you have to open your mind up here. This is not... You won't find this in a math book. But you have to just imagine. If time is beginningless, and I know in the Bible it says in the beginning, but then, you know, what was there before that? Who created God? Right before God said that, what was there? Right? There had to be a moment before that, and a moment before that, and a moment before that, and a moment before that. So in Buddhism, there's no problem with this, what we call endless regress. There's no beginning. So there's no beginning to this consciousness. There's no end to this consciousness. There could be an end to suffering, but no end of this consciousness. There's no beginning to this consciousness. And therefore, every time that I've seen this consciousness, and it's not your ego consciousness we're talking about. We're really talking about the merely labeled consciousness or I, not the Don and Robbie and, you know, whatever your name is. It's not that we're talking about. We're talking about this continuity of consciousness that's gone from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime. And it's, you know, that consciousness in every lifetime has taken rebirth. And in every one of those rebirths, you had to have a mother. You had to have a father. You had to have a mother. even if it all happens in a test tube, you know, you still had to have, you know, you had to have donors. So, this is relevant to something that I know about, but I'm not going to speak about right now. But the, you know, it's in every lifetime we've had a parents. But in Buddhism, and particularly in this meditation on remembering the kindness of mothers, or seeing all sentient beings as mothers, we've chosen that relationship because that relationship, generally speaking, is the most powerful one for most living beings, including the animal realm, right? Including animals. I mean, there are lots of stories of mothers, you know, animals who've given up their lives. You don't mess around with a mother bear, a mother grizz, when she's with her kids, because she's going to take you out. Lots of examples. So that relationship has been chosen, but in former lifetimes, we've been in every possible relationship with everybody. Friends, enemies, strangers. Countless times. And he's saying, with a strong faith in past and future lifetimes, particularly past lifetimes in this case, that really empowers this meditational equanimity. All right? So what should you come away from this meditation with? It would be advisable to reflect upon these facts continuously and not grasp at or assent unquestioningly to the appearances of friends and enemies in this life. Instead, we should cultivate a state in which we can fully discern the uncertainties of cyclic existence. So that's, if we do this meditation well, we see our friends, our enemies, and our strangers, and we go, This is not fixed. This could change and will change. In past lifetimes, it was different. In future lifetimes, it was different and will be different. And in this lifetime, it could change in a minute, couldn't it? You say a kind word to somebody, they can become a friend. You say the wrong thing to a friend, they become your enemy. And everybody that's now a friend or enemy used to be what? A stranger, you know, and your mother, and a stranger, and an enemy. It's just, you know, all over the place. So again, it's developing a real sense of like, wow, this, you know. But if you want to develop, where are we going with this? Is I want bodhicitta, which is okay. I want to liberate all sentient beings from suffering and its causes. And the way to do that is based on genuine love and compassion, not sentimentality, but genuine great love, great compassion. We say, I must get enlightened. I've got to get my act together. I've got to eliminate my faults, develop my good qualities. I've got to get enlightened so I can help others. Well, if you hate somebody, all of a sudden you got a problem, because bodhicitta is about helping all, liberating everyone. So you have to have equanimity as the foundation for everything. That's why he said every dharma practice that we do as a Mahayana practitioner, you've got to have some sense of equanimity. You've got to, people that you hate, you've got to work on letting go of that experience. And people that you like or that you're clinging to, again, not that we're always, you know, we do have special people in our lives that we have karmic relationships with, spouses and children, but the clinging to our children and spouses is not helping us or them, right? We've already shown that's kind of poisoning the relationship. So can we have like love for them without attachment? Is that possible? Is it possible? The way we define love in Buddhism is not, I love you as long as you love me back. It's the wish that beings could be, have happiness and the causes of happiness. There's nothing in there about me. It's the wish that beings could have happiness and the causes of happiness. So, very, you know, it's a powerful concept. So let's do a a little meditation on equanimity. And I'll, those of you who are new to this, just, you know, you just try to pay attention and you can close your eyes if you want to, or you can take notes if you want to. And I'm just going to kind of go all over the place. Try to remember the things that we talked about and see if this is the time when you really want to bring to mind an image of somebody that you really feel attachment to. And you want that feeling to arise. And then you're going to bring to mind somebody that you feel aversion to. You go, yuck, I don't, you know, even the sight of this person is just, you know, because a lot of you are so nice, you wouldn't hate anybody, right? But aversion is a good enough word here. You see somebody and you just feel disconnect. That's the person you want to work with. Visualize that and allow that mind of aversion to arise. And then with the so-called stranger, you want the mind of indifference to arise. Okay, so we're working with these three categories of beings, and where we want to get to is that place that I talked about earlier, where we don't cling to the friend or feel aversion to the stranger. We have this kind of sense of this whole thing is in a state of flux, constantly changing. You know, just how it is. All right, so sit up straight and we'll start out with the friend. The person, the being that you feel attachment to right now. That when you see them, you go, wow, I like it. You know, you like them. You have a good feeling. Pleasant feeling. You let that feeling arise. And then we start examining this whole thing of that, the so-called being that we label friend. Again, going back to the reason and the reasoning of past lifetimes. In every lifetime, we've had to have a parent. And, so this person's been our mother, but it's also been our worst enemy. And in many lifetimes, you know, we didn't even know them. So, you know, so this relationship and in the future, there's no guarantee that we will ever, that it could be countless eons before we reconnect with this consciousness that's currently labeled Sam or Sue or whoever, you know, the person that we label friend. And it is just a label, isn't it? This person, why do we even call them a friend? Well, we've already talked about the disadvantages of attachment, but the reason we call them a friend is because they did something nice for us. So they said something nice, they made us feel good, they did something. Could be some small gesture of kindness that they did toward us, that they directed toward us, and then they get labeled friend. But it's not a permanent label, is it? It could change. And usually, most of my friends don't tell me my faults. Most of our friends don't sit around and tell us all the things that are wrong with us. Some of us have friends like that from time to time, but not, if they did that all the time, they would quickly change categories, wouldn't they? From friend to enemy. Yeah, so, the friends usually feed our ego. Well, who's our worst enemy? From a Dharma perspective, our worst enemy is our self-cherishing, selfish, egocentric mind. The friend of our worst enemy? Are they really our friend? They're trying to feed our ego? Are they really our friend? Something to think about. So we do this well, we do this meditation well, and we realize that it is just a label. It's there's no inherently existent, permanent, always and forever friend. It's just a temporary label. We begin to notice that maybe we can let go a little bit in the beginning of the attachment toward the so-called friend. That'd be the goal. That'd be a successful meditation on the friend, on this aspect of it. Okay? Then we turn over to the enemy, the person we feel aversion toward. There we go. Now, in past lifetimes, many relationships. Been in many, many. Been my mother, my father, my best friend, my brother, my worst friend. It's been an enemy many times. A stranger many, many times. Countless times. This relationship is not something fixed. And in the future will not be fixed. And there are many faults to the mind of aversion. It's just the mind of aversion is a mind that just tortures us. It's like drinking poison, expecting somebody else to die. It doesn't help at all. So this person that we've labeled enemy, why do we label them that way? Sometimes it's some like weird karma from past lifetimes. We just meet somebody and we get ick. We feel some natural sense of distance or aversion. But usually it's something that they said or did that harmed us. We perceived it as harmful or damaging to me, to I. Okay? And so you said that to me. How dare you treat me that way? How dare you lie or cheat or steal? Whatever you did. Whatever your enemy did, the person you label that way, how could you hurt me like that? How could you do that to me? Okay? You can see there's some ego, very strong egocentricity driving this whole thing. The friend is not the friend of our ego. The friend points out our faults. We can learn from our friends. We can learn from our enemies. They're happy to point out our faults. They're happy to help show us where we need to practice, where we're weak, places where we need to get stronger. It's only in dependence upon our enemies, these so-called enemies, that we can develop patience and tolerance. That's one of the six perfections, isn't it? Of a bodhisattva. Patience, the perfection of patience. It's only in dependence upon an enemy, a difficult person, that we can develop patience. This is my ticket out of here. This person that I label enemy is my ticket to enlightenment. But I see them, I paint them black, I hate them, I push them away, I don't want anything to do with them. But when I think about it, they are a gift from the guru. They're teaching me what not to do again. They're teaching me inner, they're helping me develop inner strength. And furthermore, whatever they said or did to me is what? The fruit of my own former actions. So Ashanti Deva says, when somebody hits you with a stick, you don't get angry at the stick. The person's like the stick. The real source of, the real cause of the harm that we're experiencing is our selfish, self-cherishing mind that created the karma in the first place to be harmed. They're just the vehicle. They're just the stick by which this negativity has come back to us. So there's no absolute, inherently existing from its own side, bad guy, enemy, person that you know, to feel aversion toward. This so-called enemy, again, changeable. And there's so many reasons to actually cherish the enemy. And then we go back to the stranger, the so-called stranger, which is the vast majority of beings on this planet. The vast majority. The faceless people in the crowd. The people in the elevator. The people that we drive by every day going to work that we don't know, we'll never know them, most likely. But countless, I'm just talking about human beings. I'm talking about all sentient beings, even in the animal realm. All sentient beings are in this category of beings that we feel indifference toward. The majority of beings we feel indifference toward. And yet, these relationships will and do change, and will change in the future. So we got a sense of this, right? But now, we're visualizing in our mind's eye the so-called friend, stranger, and enemy, these three categories of beings, and now try to develop this sense of equanimity. Equal regard, you know, not clinging to the friend, not pushing away the enemy, not feeling indifferent toward the stranger. Equal regard. This is the foundation that all Dharma practice, particularly this mansion or castle of bodhicitta, has to be built on this, on a strong foundation of equanimity. Try to get a sense of it for a few minutes, and just whatever you get, you hope, without any more discursive, analytical type, contemplative stuff going on, just hold into that feeling for just a moment or two. What would be the benefits of having this kind of mind in your daily life? We're gonna continue with this sort of meditative mind. Again, try to, if you've got your eyes partially closed, close. Just try to stay in this same mindset that we're in now. And we're gonna think about recollecting all sentient beings as having been our mother. I've heard different teachers say, well, I had a terrible relationship with my mother. And, students have said that. And the teachers have said, well, just pick the one that works the best for you. Somebody was really, really, really kind to you in your life. And if your relationship with your mother was so toxic that you cannot do it with her, then try to, pick someone else. That would be my advice, and the advice of other teachers that I've heard. But again, I'm going to do this from the perspective of mother and having it been a good relationship. So we, again, in the context of beginningless mind and beginningless lifetimes, and it is logical, even if you don't believe in past lifetimes, it makes more sense than anything else. There's no first moment. There's something before that. And then there was something before that, and something before that. How can you posit anything else with a rational mind? And the mind, which is formless, the body, yeah, sperm and egg, we know what caused that, but the mind's formless. And its cause was a former moment of mind. So what, you know, we say, what is the cause of the first moment of mind of this life? A moment of mind of a former life. Bingo. That proves former lifetimes. And that mind goes back. Former moment of mind before that, moment of mind before that. Each new moment of mind is the product of all the former moments of mind. Okay? All right, so, and we've had this mind forever. It's beginningless. And every life we had a mother. Your mother of this life, think about her because we're going to use her in a minute. Your mother of this life has been your mother in countless former lifetimes. Again, I'm just creatively aligned with this, even if you don't believe it in your heart of hearts, see what happens to your mind when you begin to think this way. Your mother of this life has been your mother in countless former lifetimes. She's given up her body for you. When you were an animal or a deer or all these, you know, in whatever realm of samsara you were born, your mother of this lifetime has been your mother countless former lifetimes and will be your mother again in countless future lifetimes. And in every life that you've ever had, you had a mother. And every mother has been your mother in countless former lifetimes and will once again be your mother in countless future lifetimes. I have been your mother. The person sitting next to you has been your mother countless times. We don't recognize her. It's a different continuity. It's a different set of aggregates, right? But, you know, that consciousness, that continuity has been at some former lifetime was our mother. And will again be in the future. So we go, you know, our father of this lifetime has been our father many, many times in the past. Will it be again in the future? Has been our mother, our siblings, our friends, the strangers in this world, all the insects, every sentient being, excluding none, has been our mother countless times and will again be our mother countless times. And so we, you know, just kind of blows our mind. All of a sudden, you know, we imagine that all living beings have had that really intimate, close relationship with me of mother to child. And if this meditation's done well, then what's said is, whenever we see a living being, we immediately, we have no concept of why, because we've done this meditation and it's we have some actualization of it, some realization of it, we immediately feel connected to others. Be it an animal, a person, we immediately feel connected to everyone. Dalai Lama is a great example if people have ever seen him, of somebody who got this one down really solid. Immediately feels connected to everyone. Then the next step is remembering the kindness of our mother. And so it's best, again, if your relationship with your mom in this life is really great, then that's going to help. So we go through what mothers do. I mean, and there are a lot of people in this room that are parents, that are mothers. 9 months. And it's not easy. It's not just about pickles and ice cream. It's about throwing up and being morning sickness and carrying this creature around inside of you that starts kicking and you can't sleep and your body's changing and things are not like they used to be and the hormones are changing and you're more vulnerable to certain sicknesses and throughout that whole time, no matter what's going on, your mom's very careful to take her prenatal vitamins and she doesn't take drugs and she doesn't do anything that would harm you because she, even before you were born, as soon as she found out she was pregnant with you when you were so little, you were the size of a peanut, she was in love with you. 100% in love with you. And then for those 9 months, you grew inside of her womb. And then, again, not easy. Not sleeping, particularly the last, few weeks, cannot get comfortable. You got about 30 pounds hanging off your stomach. And it's not fun. It's not comfortable. It's a difficult time. And yet she perseveres through that because she knows that, there's something amazing growing inside her. And she's totally in love with you before you're born. And then, I used to deliver babies and I've seen this time and time again. Women who go through literally a hellacious labor and screaming and very uncomfortable and all the pain of bringing a baby into the world. And immediately after the baby's born, put the baby on the mom's breast, on the chest, and she's smiling, face just lights up. She's so happy because you made it. You survived. And she's completely filled with love. Would die for you in a second. Would die for you in a second. Would put your happiness ahead of hers in a second. And then takes care of you all the way through those first few months, gets up in the middle of the night, breastfeeds you, does whatever she does, but you don't sleep that much. So she doesn't sleep that much. So huge sacrifices all the way through infancy, changing poopy diapers and getting you dressed and taking you out and showing you off and bragging about you and creating more negative karma but so happy, so much in love with, you. And then gradually we grow up and we go to school, and she's making breakfast and you didn't get enough bacon. And what does she do? She gives you the bacon off her plate. She gives you her food. She puts you in front of her every chance she can. And she teaches you how to walk. She teaches you how to talk. She teaches you, usually the first things that you ever learn, even though you become more accomplished, your mom's your first teacher. And that first day you go off to school, ooh, it's like, ouch, And then all the way through school, all the problems you had, all the relationship problems, all the school problems, every time you had a triumph, she rejoiced. Every time you suffered, it was like she was suffering. It was very personal. And And then, so fast forward, even today, your mom may be dead, you know, maybe you might be fortunate enough for your mom to still be alive. But when she was alive, you know, if there was anybody that would not throw you under the bus, it would be your mom. You know, you hear about these, you know, these people that are mass murderers, and their moms, oh, he couldn't have done that. There's no way. Not my baby. You know, it's like she will love you no matter what. Fathers are different. They're more, you know, generally speaking, a little bit more demanding. But mothers have this unconditional love for their children that is unbelievable. Unbelievable. So your mom in this life had that kind of love for you. Feel what that must be like. Try to see, you know, when you do this meditation, you want to visualize your mom really at the age she was when she was carrying you as a fetus, not as an older person. And then you can imagine her growing old and losing her health and getting sick and all of that and the sacrifices that she made. But the point is, you want to develop this genuine sense of love and appreciation for your mom. And now, look at all the moms we've had. The person sitting next to you, your friends, your family, the strangers, the enemies, have all been as kind to you as your own mother. They've all shown you that same kind of loving kindness and sacrifice. So we extrapolate that feeling of love that we have for our mom, this pure, you know, pure wish that she be happy and have the causes of happiness, we extrapolate that to universal living beings. And we remember the kindness of all of our mothers, all of our past and future mothers, actually. They're all going to be mothers again. They've been mothers in the past, they'll be mothers again. And they'll show us this kind of amazing kindness. And the next step after that is wishing to repay their kindness. Wishing to repay their kindness. And sometimes it's taught like, it's a, well, you know, it, from a spiritual perspective, and even from a worldly perspective, if someone's been very kind to you, it's just good manners. it's the way it ought to happen. It doesn't happen that way all the time, but it, you know, we should repay the kindness of others. It's not somebody else's job to repay the kindness of my mom. It's my job to repay her kindness. So we develop this wish to repay the kindness of all of our kind mother sentient beings. And what's the best way to repay their kindness? What's the best way to repay their kindness? Well, sure, food, clothing, and shelter, that's important. Gotta have that. And medicine. Gotta have the basics. But the best way to repay their kindness is to teach them what to do and what not to do. The Dharma is to give them an inner life that will lead them to supreme enlightenment. to help guide them and support them and nurture them in that kind of evolution. That's the best way to repay their kindness. And then the next point is called great love, which is different than just love, because normally we think, you know, again, love is more for people that are near and dear. But this is love for, because we developed equanimity, you know, and we recall their kindness. It's just the natural fallout of having done these other meditations, that we want them, we want all universal living beings, we want them to have happiness and the causes of happiness. We want them, so may you, we can think like this, as you imagine yourself, you know, surrounded by universal living beings and all in human form, think, may you have happiness and the causes of happiness. That's love. That's true love. That's what we call great love. And then based on the feeling of closeness, so you have to meditate on love before you meditate on compassion. Why? Because if you don't like somebody and you see them suffering, you could actually rejoice, couldn't you? So it's important to have this meditation on love to be really strong. Then we recognize that sentient beings, all of these universal sentient beings are just like us. They're caught in this cycle of uncontrolled causation called samsara. And they're all going to take their past and throw it in front of them and walk back into it and do it over and over and over again. And it's going to be miserable again and again. They're going to have to be born and die again and again. And it's just terrible. It's sad. Wouldn't it be great if we could all stop? Wouldn't it be great if we could all stop? So may they be free of suffering and its causes. Develop love, develop that sense of warmth and love toward living beings. Then we recognize that they're suffering. Then the wish that they be free of suffering arises naturally. May they be free of suffering and its causes. This is great. This is what is unique to Mahayana Buddhism. You know, this emphasis on universal compassion. So I gave a handout, I gave the homework, and I only did, you know, these things. I didn't do what's called the supreme, supreme wish, sometimes called the supreme wish. I didn't do that one. I didn't do generation of bodhicitta, because we'll do that. In the next week, and then the following weeks, we'll get to those different meditations. But I think this is good. This is enough for the next week. Okay. And I gave out a handout which has 12 points. Usually equanimity is not included. Usually talk about the 11 when you combine the 7-point cause and effect and exchanging self for others. There's 11 points, but there are 12. In here because I included equanimity as one of the meditations. So you do that. One last thing. I don't know how many people are going to do this. We'll see. But I talked to Donna Cease, and I asked her, I said, can rather than have our last class be, I think the 16th of February, but we would do it on the Saturday, the 13th of February, and have it be like an all-day retreat, so people can have a chance. And I know everybody's not into that, but you know, my feeling is that it's very difficult. It's impossible, almost impossible, unless you have very, very lucky person to get any kind of deep experience of this practice an hour a week. And here we have a chance in about 8 hours to do these 12 meditations in a more of a retreat environment here on a Saturday morning. We'll start at 7:30. Well, maybe that's a good time. 7:30. We'll finish up at 5 so you can take your sweetheart out for your Valentine's dinner or whatever. And we'll do this practice all day on Saturday. So Donna's going to be putting that out. We're going to invite other people in the community because other people might want to do that. Okay? If you do want to do it, if you cannot make it for whatever reason, and you're doing Discovering Buddhism, I'll still sign off on it if you'll spend some time doing your own little retreat. Okay? So let's do the dedication prayer on page, what is it? 246. Shanti Deva's dedication. May all beings everywhere plagued by suffering of body and mind obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid of a little with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms, the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing and the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power. May people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, and as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So, all you kind mothers, sentient beings, have a good week. We'll see you next Monday night.